Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about the Magic Jar, a spell that's been in every edition of D&D. You put your soul in an object, and you can possess the body of other people. It may be the best protection ever for a wizard, but will it reshape the tone of your entire campaign? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we start discussing magic jars, I want to remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll get an invite to that Discord server. And get yourself all set up with an account there and get logged in so that about 10 minutes after the show, we will host our live video chat with you.
We love hanging with our patrons, and big thanks to our patrons like Bacrius for checking in that we are currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream, and thank you so much for that. So, Paul, why? We're doing a whole episode on one spell, and one single D&D spell. You know, I was thinking this morning of, like, if somebody forced me to define, like, what does an edition count as D&D, I might say, does that edition include Magic Jar? Because almost every edition has had Magic Jar in the core rules, the original D&D, including first edition.
Not really the spell one thinks of as like classic indicative of D&D, although some of those spells don't fit that rule, right? Like Magic Missile, not in every edition.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Some people are out there playing original D&D with no Magic Missile.
So I've got my Magic Jar. I'm ready to go. Let's do it.
Oh, no. How long does it take to drink? And how creepy is that going to be? No, don't, no. This is where Dan, when he's a player, like, I'm throwing burning oil on Paul to prevent this horrible thing from happening. Don't do that.
I never thought of the magic jar looking like it contains a liquid, but now I want that because I want my players to decide to drink it. What happens if a player drinks the contents of a wizard's magic jar? Okay.
So what editions is that possible in? Actually, what editions is that feasible? I'll actually start out by pointing out, original D&D specifically said could be any object. Could be any object, including a simple rock. And then starting with first edition, you had to have a pricey gem or crystal, and the price has gone up with every edition. Inflation, Paul. Inflation. It was 100 gold pieces at third edition, and now it's 500 with fifth edition. Can we stop the inflation of the magic jar gem? Please, people.
You know, researching for this show definitely gave me sort of the old Spell Through the Ages vibes, because I tried to. I have a stack of books here because I tried to look up Magic Jar in every single edition and find out what's going on with this spell. Also, like, the duration. The duration is, is it only third that, like, really reins it in and then they go back?
It is. I discovered the same thing this morning. Yep.
Yeah, most of the editions are like, it's basically forever. And then third edition is like, maybe an hour is enough.
An hour per level. An hour per level is what third says. And then, to my surprise, fifth edition switched it back, and it currently says until dispelled, which is exactly what it said in original D&D Swords and Spells. We've come full circle back to until dispelled is the official duration.
All right, give us the basics, Dan. What is consistent about Magic Jar throughout the editions, if anything?
So the idea is, you put your soul, we're going to say, in an object, and then you can possess other bodies, and you can walk, you can possess that, you can walk around in other bodies, and then when, I guess, you're in danger, you can switch your soul back to the object, either just before or after the other body dies or gets in some kind of danger, and then you can possess other bodies. So, you know, this, and I'll just think just for a second about, like, where the heck did this come from? Yes, it was an original D&D, the first ever publication, 1974. I'm guessing that Gygax and company were probably looking at a Fritz Leiber story. And I don't know if you want to throw the cover of that book up on screen right now, just sure, so people can look at it. And interesting, it's called Adept's Gambit, and it's the first ever story written, not the first one published, but the first ever Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser story that Leiber wrote, all the way back in 1936, I believe. And he even was communicating and getting feedback on it by H.P. Lovecraft. And you can see this volume here. There's a particular volume fairly recently that includes both the original story plus the feedback from Lovecraft, who we know is incredibly generous to other authors and incredibly supportive to other people as they were just getting started out like this. And the plot largely revolves around a horrible villainous wizard who has transferred his life force into a young woman and is using her to extend his life and his villainy. And by the end of it, they finally realize that he has been protecting his life force in a couple of rocks, in a couple of stones from an ancient temple, basically. And it's the Grey Mouser that manages to finally terminate that. I think Leiber, that you can point to a bunch of ancient pieces of mythology, including Indian, Irish, Slavic, Native American, that have these kinds of stories. I think there's like a folktale study archetype number 302 that they call Giant Without a Heart myth, where some villain has saved their heart or their soul or their death in an object in a faraway land that you have to go find before you can terminate them. So it's probably where they got that. And as some people in our chat are pointing out, this is something you normally connote with a villain, with somebody evil doing this. And you have to go way out of your way in order to terminate that. So clearly that is what the D&D magic jar spell is mainlining. And it's been there forever. And what an interesting aspect to it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's certainly building on some conceits that we see in a lot of different things, like even just Charm Person, right? Of that conceit of taking over or a wizard using their magic to you know, dominate another entity, right? And control. But this one's particularly interesting, I think, because the wizard, their soul, right, is inhabiting the body of the victim. But I think also one thing I kept trying to find out in the various editions was what did they say about where the victim's consciousness or soul or whatever is when this happens? And it kind of varies.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed that one.
Now that you mention it, it's not normally the top thing that I'm thinking about, but you're totally right. And I mean, and Paul's right. In general, this is one of these spells that varies wildly by edition, just varies wildly. And it gets more and more details and all the details change. And it's such a wild thing to kind of spot. So, yeah, I know that in first edition, the victim's spirit is technically still in their body and they get occasional saving throws to try to, I'll say, throw off the caster. But there's other editions where the victim's soul goes into the magic jar and gets transferred with the caster. And I don't know which editions do that, frankly.
Yeah. It seems to vary between those two, right?
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of rules around how frequently can you jump back and forth, what kind of checks can the victim do to try to reassert control, if anything. What state is the victim in? I want to think there's one version, I honestly can't remember which edition it's in, where the victim is transferred into the jar and retains consciousness and perception and can see what's going on around them. And the jar must be kept within a certain distance of the caster for all of this to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So just like they're carrying around this imprisoned person, which I guess is true, even if the victim stays in their body, right? They're imprisoned and like,
yes,
you know, I guess it's a little unclear of like, are they conscious of what's going on? Do they, you know, if they reassert control, or they regain control of their body, do they remember all the things that have happened?
Great question. That's one the DM's got to fill in. I feel like the biggest...
Surely the additions tell us raw mechanics, right? Like, if I'm a wizard and I use magic jar and I possess another wizard's body, whose spells do I use? Mine or theirs or both?
Okay, the consensus is mostly the additions say only yours. And I'm pretty sure first edition specifically says... doesn't first edition say you probably can't use the victim's spells? I think that's what it says, right? Oh, but mostly the additions say you can use your spells and not the victim's. And I think, you know, and then by third edition, it's very clear you're stealing their physical stuff, but you have all your normal mental stuff, very much like a polymorph spell, which is a fairly easy ruling to get behind, frankly. But yeah, early on, there was a little bit of a question mark about, are you getting all of their... I think first edition says you can possibly get some of their knowledge, I think. This is actually not the main thing I normally
One of the things I found most interesting, I've got the first edition spell in front of me right now. One of the most interesting things I found about that is that it devotes a huge quantity of its text on how to calculate the saving throw. It's a very complicated system.
Oh yeah.
For reasons I can't imagine.
I totally agree. That's Gary, I don't know, being on some kind of happy substance when he wrote that's completely unnecessary. They retained it in second edition. They shouldn't have.
It does say the possessor can call upon rudimentary knowledge of the possessed, but not upon the real knowledge, i.e. a possessor will not know the language or spells of the possessed.
There you go. He will know the rudimentary knowledge, but not the real knowledge.
But not the real knowledge. Thanks. Yeah. How do I draw that line?
I want to point out one fascinating thing. So we're looking at the spell. I have that on my other image, Paul, if we could just bring up that text for 1 second. Because I want to point out that if you're looking, you know, first edition started this bit of every spell has a school, right? Spells are maybe they're in the divination school or the evocation or something like that. And I think like with second edition, we're used to there being 7 or 8 schools, and they build that out to like specialist wizards. And so in first edition, where they're tagging, you get the title, and then in parentheses, you get the tag, and I have it in the red box here. Magic Jar is tagged with the magic school of possession. And I will point out that there is no other spell in the game with this school. The possession school is made just for Magic Jar and nothing else. It's completely unique just to they had to make up a brand new magic school just for Magic Jar and no other spell. And you could have imagined it being part of like Charm Person or Suggestion, but it's not. It's just Magic Jar.
That is amazing. Isn't that nuts? Now I want to dig through. Does second edition retain that?
Pretty sure it gets scrubbed in second edition.
That is fascinating. I don't even know.
But hypothetically, if you come in and say I'm a specialist wizard in possession, then you just have Magic Jar. and no other spell.
Yeah. Yeah, by second edition, they've made it necromancy.
Okay, yeah. There you go.
Fascinating. Yeah. I can't remember which edition it was I read that you maybe have access to the target's spells. I also found really bizarre. There was some edition that mentioned that. Maybe BX? Holy crap.
I'm looking at it right now.
Clearly, this is a spell that varies wildly given how much confusion we have around it.
BX says no spells of the possessed may be used, so BX does not allow that.
Fascinating. Here's another little perk of the spell that I find really entertaining, which is how do you target the creature you're trying to possess? What kind of senses do you have while in the jar? How do you figure out who you're possessing? And I think it's third edition that goes into like great detail about this, which I find really fascinating. Because it claims that you can sense life forces and you can kind of get a vague sense of their relative power, but you can't differentiate them. And it goes on to give the example, if two 10th level characters are attacking a hill giant with 12 hit dice and four yes. ogres, 4 hit dice, you could determine that there are 3 stronger and 4 weaker life forces within range, all with positive life energy. You choose to take over either a stronger or weaker creature, but which stronger or weaker creature you attempt to possess is determined randomly. And I like that here, you know, apparently 10th level, 10 hit die versus 12 hit die, those get lumped together, but the 4 hit die is clearly weaker. What's the difference? Where do I draw the line?
I actually think it's bare in the text that's currently on screen in first edition. There's a little nugget that, as usual, gets blown up in third edition. I'm trying to find. Oh God, where is it? I saw it.
Yep.
I'm not finding it right now, but I thought, unless it's in second, unless it's a little nugget in second.
Here's the piece I was looking for to jump back to the spell question. Yep, first edition does indeed say the possessor can even use the spells he or she knows. There I guess that falls under non-specific knowledge, the general. Oh. So weird.
And I found what I was looking for that is on screen right at the moment. So the fifth or so sentence says, from this magic jar, the life force can sense and attack any creature within the spell range radius, but what the creature is not determinable from the magic jar.
Fascinating.
And that's all first edition says about it. Third edition gets you some kind of...
The nuance of the details aside, right, the basic gist of this, right, of like, I'm going to put my soul in a jar and then use it to like possess, you know, another creature. And then I find that very interesting. Like, I'm imagining this case of like, okay, my soul's in a jar and then I target somebody else and either I swap with them or we're now both our souls are in their body. There's the jar, which may or may not have a soul in it. And then there's my body, my original body, which is, I guess, mm-hmm. just hanging out comatose somewhere. Cool. Mm-hmm. What are the moral implications of this spell, Dan? Am I a good wizard if I'm casting magic jar? Am I doing... Does it have any effect on my alignment?
My opinion is that it's terrible. My Dan Collins' amateur opinion is that this seems absolutely terrible. I mean, you are... Clearly, you're taking consent away from people, and you're effectively enslaving them. And obviously, this seems like the most horror movie terrible thing you can possibly do.
It seems pretty bad. Like you're not just killing your victim; you're torturing them for a while first.
Yeah, yeah.
And then eventually, they're probably going to die.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's hideous. Yeah, it's hideous.
This came up, honestly, this whole topic came up because Dan and I were discussing what is it called? Wizards War Zone is an event that Dan runs occasionally at game conventions and such, where each player plays a maximum level wizard on a battle mat, right, in an arena style combat where all the wizards are trying to beat each other up, right? Ostensibly with the motivation of testing some of the higher level spells, right? Get a little playtest of high level spells by sicking wizards against each other. And Dan told me at the most recent convention that he includes a little note here that we assume all the wizards have magic jar active, which is why they're even willing to do this at all. I'm like, that seems logical. Great. Oh, we all have an escape hatch. Great. So we're willing to go and duke it out on this weird arena because we know that it's not really for keeps. But the moral implication just immediately hit me of like, oh, this is awful. Wait, so now it's to a blood sport, Dan? Now we're using magic jar as a blood sport?
Right. Using unwilling people's bodies, is the implication. I usually don't dig into that in the actual games, but there is this really terrifying horror movie backstory to the whole event. And it's true that I discovered that I felt like Magic Jar, again, with its unique spell school in first edition, I had to deal with this one spell in a special way. You know, I think initially, before I started doing that, it was, I think, our friend Steve Buckley of Second Best Role Playing, who stepped into the game, took Magic Jar, and as his first action on some kind of desert battle map, was like, I Magic Jar myself into a rock. Can my opposing wizards, are my opposing wizards going to know what rock I'm in? And how much perception do I have from the rock that I'm in? And I'm like, oh man, that's, I don't know any of that. I don't know any of that. And I'm going to have to go with ruling, obviously. I didn't dig up a book at the time, but I'm going to have, this is going to cause me to do this same research again about like, what's your perception? Where is it? And what kind of thing can you put yourself in? And afterwards, I decided that it actually would make sense uniquely if every wizard comes in with this. You're not going to be using it in the game. And it also just makes sense that the wizards are not actually literally being terminated, but somebody is. So yeah, it's a one spell. It's the one and only spell that I allow people to come into the game prepared, and it's actually mandatory. And there's a kind of a terrifying backstory behind it.
It is fascinating, and I just delighted in this conversation. I was like, we have to have this conversation online, Tam, because the next logical jump my head made after determining that Magic Jar is a heinous evil spell is that this is clearly a step towards lichhood, and in fact, like, maybe this is in fact how liches are made. Right, because of the whole lich phylactery thing, and that sent me down a whole other rabbit hole of research of like, where do liches come from, and when do those show up in the game, and how do their phylacteries work? Is it the same as a Magic Jar spell, or is it different? And lo and behold, vastly inconsistent is the answer.
Vastly inconsistent, even less consistent, because it's not part of the core rules actually. So we should point out that Magic Jar predates liches. So original D&D in 74 had the Magic Jar spell, had this idea of wizards are going to be putting their souls in objects. And the Lich wasn't part of the game until the Greyhawk supplement that came out a year later. Now, the next question is, what does that supplement distinctly not have, Paul?
Yeah, it's no phylactery, no mention of a phylactery whatsoever, not present.
Right.
And in fact, surprisingly, you don't even find the phylactery necessarily, not in a tangible way, in first edition, mm-hmm. right? It's mentioned in the Monster Manual entry that there is a it's mentioned very offhand, right? It says something about...
Among other things.
The Monster Manual.
Yeah, yeah.
here we go.
Like they're going to use an A and a B in a phylactery.
Yep. Yeah. So it retains its status by certain conjurations, enchantments, and a phylactery. And that is the only mention of phylactery in first edition at all, which is fascinating.
Doesn't say it comes back when you destroy it. Doesn't say you need the phylactery to get rid of it. That's not any part
of the... Doesn't say what a phylactery is, Dan. This is clearly like homework for the reader. Go get your dictionary and look up what the heck a phylactery is.
Well, I will say, if you look, there's multiple magical phylacteries in the DM's guide. And if you look them up in the DM's guide, they do have a little, they're in the index, and the DM's guide will actually tell you what a phylactery is. Now, it didn't come out until 2 years later, but.
Now I have to get the DM's phylactery guide. Because I'll tell you what the dictionary says is not helpful.
Phylactery. So I'm looking at the index, the glossary in the first edition DM's guide. Phylactery is an arm wrapping with a container holding religious writings, thus the form of an amulet and charm. Now, to be clear, this is clearly alluding to the Jewish, and someone correct me on this, I believe Telafel, which I believe holds part of the Torah on a person's body during services, I think. Is what they're alluding to. And obviously, you know, D&D stole from every tradition and every culture, you know, in a creative way. And that's pretty clearly where they're getting that.
Yeah. Yeah, so the dictionary gives me that origin of from Judaism, either of two small black leather cubes containing a piece of parchment inscribed with verses 4-9 of Deuteronomy 6, 13-21 of Deuteronomy 11, and 1-16 of Exodus 13. One is attached with straps to the left arm and the other to the forehead during weekday morning prayers by Orthodox and conservative Jewish men. Yeah. Now, I find that really fascinating because as you dig through lich entries, you will find occasionally it does describe what a phylactery looks like and that it often describes it as a small box. And it often describes it as being attached to the body of the lich, which is not a thing I ever realized until I did this research. I always assumed the phylactery, much like the vampire's coffin, would be hidden away someplace secret. I never imagined it was attached to their body.
Yeah. Great point.
No idea.
Great point. I'm also just going to give an extra point to just D&D in general. I would not know that about. There were so many things that I wouldn't know about cultures that aren't mine that I frankly learned through. I got to learn more about this because of some kind of random D&D reference, and I personally feel a lot more educated because of it. Frankly,
yeah. Good on them, I guess, for culturally robbing every subculture.
So where a puzzle that came up for us this morning is where in D&D is it first established that liches can come back from destruction via their device? And it's not in original D&D, it's not in the first edition monster manual, and it's not in an adventure. And we had to go scrambling. Remind me now. I can't remember where we found it.
You're talking about the article Blueprint for a Lich by Len Lakofka, which appeared in Dragon Magazine issue number 26, which by the way, never uses the word phylactery, but here never it is. Here's the connective tissue. Does use the word jar an awful lot.
Well, because, you know, the lich needs these spells, needs three spells. Number one, magic jar. Number two, trap the soul. Number three, enchant an item. So they actually, the lich, according to Lakofka there in 1979, they have to make a very pricey special container item that he's calling the jar. And among other things, the lich has to magic jar into that thing. And when the lich is about to, and then has very many, many, many paragraphs, many paragraphs about the details and the things and the potion and the ingredients and the process, and including some really, really hideous stuff. They weren't pulling punches in those days. I think step, I don't know, 18 out of 20 is you have to eat your own body. And then once it's all done, you can transfer your soul before your new body gets destroyed into what they're calling the jar. So how fascinating is that they're not using the word phylactery, they're actually using magic jar as the basis for liches. Makes sense.
I mean, you know what? This article then is forcing me to look up the spell Trap the Soul, which I can't say that I ever was aware of, ever dug into. But sure enough, here it is in my first edition Player's Handbook, which immediately begins with, this spell similar to the magic jar. Oh, okay. No idea. Does that spell exist in Greyhawk? It basically looks like an offensive version of magic jar, where you're just sending someone else into a jar. You go in a jar.
Trap the soul is advanced only. So it's advanced D&D. We're not going to see that in original D&D. We're not going to see that in BX. And I will say that is imprisonment is a separate spell. I was going to say that that's inspired by a Jack Vance story, insistment. I'm thinking of imprisonment, which is a separate, I think. Anyway, but anyway, that's why Trap the Soul is going to back reference Magic Jar, because Magic Jar predates it. And that was on Gary's mind when he wrote the new advanced Trap the Soul.
There you go. You ever used any of these spells, Dan, in your actual campaign play?
What a great question.
Have them come up?
I mean, the short story is basically...
Yeah, me either. And the thing I always wonder about it is, are these spells that are being placed in the game for sort of background seeds for adventure building? Like, I really only expect the bad guys to have them. Or are you really encouraging your players to run around and start trapping souls and magic jarring their own souls and moving souls around?
I think that's a great question. I think it's a reasonable guess to say that probably that was just going to be villains. The fact that second edition tags it as necromancy, and again, I'm someone who holds to necromancy being fundamentally bad. Not everybody does. Seems to signal that, you know, and if you look at the literature, it was villains using it. That is probably what was on Gary's mind, probably when they first invented it.
Yeah, I find that really fascinating that in the design of D&D, there was never any attempt, right? Like, we see the growth of spell lists, right? From just magic user and cleric to now then, you know, druid and illusionist, and like the explosion of different spell lists for different classes that is rife throughout the editions of D&D. But you never really see, these are spells for villains only. Right? These are not spells for any player. Here are spells just for the bad guys. I think is... Because I feel like they could have done that. And that would be interesting.
Yeah. I feel that arguably... And it's another spell that I spend a lot of time thinking about how to, where the hell it came from, where it dialed in right, and also how to pronounce it. I feel like you could make an argument that the Gesh spell is how I'm going to say it today, G-A-G-E-A-S, which is arguably either Gesh, Geish, Geish, or Gas, is possible. Like original D&D says, you run into a wizard in a castle, bam, they're going to Gesh you to go get treasure for them.
Yep.
That could arguably be an NPC-only spell, you know, like the trap, the soul spell in advanced, which seems like I'm summoning a demon kind of thing. Not many, though. Very, very few.
Yeah. But they exist, right? I wasn't meaning to imply that there were no other spells like that, but rather that it's interesting that the rules never thought to segregate that into a list over here on the side. This is not for players. This is just for bad guys, right? Although, of course, you know, D&D also has always walked the line of, like, these are just rules to simulate a fantasy reality. Yeah. And, it makes no... Right? Like, I feel like the idea of, like, let's all play a chaotic evil party, right? Like, that idea has been floating around forever, right? And I feel like a lot of long-running D&D groups have toyed with that idea at one time or another.
Totally. Totally. I think I've had a party that basically did do that. Briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, I can think of one single case in the core. Original D&D does separate out Finger of Death from the standard spell list into a separate section and says this is only for chaotic evil high priests.
I mean, similarly, you get like the reversed, you know, the ability to reverse cleric spells, which generally is like exists. And then you're given this kind of nebulous, like, you probably should never do this. It's actually quite bad, right?
Yes.
Kind of notion. Okay. Yeah. And I've heard people talking about it, like, it's like reading the Bible backwards, right? Like, you're not being a good Christian if you do this, right? You're not being a good wizard or a good cleric if you're reading your prayers backwards.
Yes, totally. I haven't heard that. That suits. That tracks for me. That makes sense. Now, I feel like for Magic Jar, I feel like the cut line that makes it very interesting, and probably newer players have a really different take on it possibly, is the whole duration range of return issue that you were talking about earlier, Paul. So in original D&D, first edition, BX, there's no limited duration on it, and there's also no limited range of return on it. So as far as I can tell, the wizard only ever needs to cast Magic Jar once. You cast Magic Jar once, your safekeeping your soul in the magic jar. You can take over other bodies and you can just travel any, you can go anywhere in the world for as long as you want. And if you happen to get, you know, in danger or destroyed on another, the other side of the world, you're back in the jar. You're fine. You just need to get another body to come by at some point. And then that, so it's basically an infinite spell, an infinite life spell, if you look at it in a certain that way. And then that's so radical that they start nerfing it real hard, starting around second edition. So second edition throws down this very limited range of return. You got to be within 10 feet per level, like maybe 100 feet. And if your new body expires outside of 100 feet from the jar, you're done. So it's funny, Bakal, because maybe I have a blind spot. You mentioned like carry the jar around with you, which is actually something I tend not to think about. I also think about it maybe in the mythological sense where it's normally like stored in some foreign location in a hard to reach place where the adventurer presumably can't find it.
That vibes with the other instance we have of this, right? Of like the vampire's coffin, right? The vampire as an enemy goes out and fight him. And then if you kill the vampire, turns to gas, retreats to the coffin to reform.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and again, as like this relation it to it being kind of like what liches do, right? I imagine I always expected liches to operate the same way. I have a secret phylactery. It's hidden somewhere.
Yeah.
If I get killed, I return to the phylactery, reform.
It seems like if you were carrying carrying it around with you, it would seem like an obvious critical risk that once word that wizards or liches do that is that everybody fighting a wizard or lich is now immediately scours the body for the container to destroy. It seems like an obvious security error.
And
so it seems like you really want it someplace else as your safe house.
You know, the other thing that's entering my brain here is that, like, if I am for the sake of adventure design, if I'm trying to create a villain or an adventure, liches are gross and fun and bizarre to play with. But like, I almost think like a more nefarious villain is just a high level wizard with magic jar going, right? And you get a high level wizard, right? And I love this idea. You know, I guess I have this idea percolating in my head of like, if lichhood was more like magic jar, would you get something where like, after I inhabit the body of my victim, they just start rapidly aging and decomposing. And then I just gotta, so I have windows of time where I'm like passable in society. And then I turn into this horror show and then I want to jump.
I support this.
Etc. Yeah. I think
Dan supports this message. Do that.
It's great, right? Right? Like, well, this, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, one of the pieces of research I was trying to do when I was digging into liches, which is total tangential, but was just sort of like, how do liches continue on, right? Do they just live forever or not? What do they need to survive? And that varies from edition to edition. And in first edition, it's kind of hidden because I only found this in the monster manual under the definition of larva. That apparently liches eat them, right? Larvae are specifically evil souls that got sent to Hades or something, and they look like worms with human faces. And there's this little note in the larva entry about how liches consume them. And then you see this later, I think, in maybe third edition, where it talks about liches having to consume souls. Is that in third edition, I think? It's very strange. If you try to follow liches through the editions, it's really weird, because in third edition, they're not even a full monster. They're a template in the back of the monster manual that you can apply to other creatures.
Weird.
it's like giving a monster levels or something. You can lichify a monster, and here's instructions on how to do that, but they don't get their own entry, which is very strange. But there is reference to in some cases that liches need to regularly potentially consume souls, or possibly
great catch.
And that kind of works with larvae, right? Because larvae essentially are souls.
Yeah.
The souls that got damned because of how evil they were.
Great catch on that. I wouldn't have remembered at all. That's a great catch on the larvae in first edition. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do like the idea of a wizard who is seeking eternal life and does it through jumping bodies, and that, like, it doesn't work perfectly, and so they're just constantly, like, deteriorating, and then they're having to jump. So you get these lovely windows of, especially if it's fairly fast. I want it to be like a fast process, right? I want it to take, like, I don't know, a month before they're like, oh, this body's not usable anymore. I gotta jump, right? And then you're just constantly wondering, like, well, who's the lich or who's the evil wizard? Like, who are they? You know, are they hiding in town somewhere? Have they dragged somebody, right?
Anyway. I have, you know, like, I don't mind the lich background being mysterious for the DM to sketch in however they like in their campaign or their situation. That's fine. You know, it's a slightly different thing that you've got Magic Jar on the general wizard list that's possibly acquirable by any player character. And then I feel like you need a little bit, and even with higher level spells, right? It was normally fifth level. Now in fifth edition, they bumped it up to sixth level for its worth. So it's a fairly high level spell, but you need a little bit more definition to it if it's on the table for possible player use. I will say that, you know, I do think of Liber's Adept's Gambit, and the victim there was carrying around the evil wizard for years and years. So I do tend to think myself of a wizard doing it like kind of like the standard vampire trope of, they got a lifetime in this body, and then, you know, when it aged out a couple decades, they transferred to another young body, and they're just hanging out possibly for centuries or millennia, exchanging the identity over time from this one single spell. Oh, also terrible. Great.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, shoot.
Now, I'm going to, okay, so here's
about to go with that.
Well, let me make my pitch. So I'm going to reveal a little bit in Dan's campaign backstory. You know, I was watching, what did I see? I was seeing Brennan Mulligan of Dimension 20 speaking a little while back, saying that people have pointed out that all of his plots are basically about capitalism being villainous, and I feel very warm and fuzzy, because that's very close to my initial intro to new people in a D&D campaign. For me, is basically, I basically say, you know, you have these skills and no one will hire you, and no one's hiring soldiers because everything's peaceful, so you're gonna have to go make trouble for yourself, otherwise you can't feed yourself. And I feel that in the long term, I might possibly hypothesize that aren't all wizards really incentivized to do this over time? I'm like, if you're a wizard that has moral scruples or your alignment is lawful and say, I am absolutely not going to do this, well, then you're going to expire at like a normal lifespan. But the wizards that, I don't know, like I'm a wizard Peter Thiel or something like that, that say I'm gonna there's this opportunity for me to vastly expand my lifespan by using other people's bodies with Magic Jar. Of course, I'm gonna do that. It seems like you're highly motivated to make that hideous, hellish bargain, and then over time, aren't the vast majority of high-level wizards going to be in that situation? And I mean, like, if we assume that it's changing your alignment, aren't most wizards going to be high-level, chaotic, thousand-year-old living wizards through Magic Jar? And that's mostly what wizardry is about, possibly. And that's in your campaign is secretly being run by these worm-tongued, thousand-year-old Magic Jarred wizards. And that's kind of like, Your whole campaign is secretly being run by these guys just because of this one freaking spell, Magic Jar? Isn't that the clear logical implication that your whole campaign's being run by these assholes? Right? Am I crazy? I think that's just a series of logical conclusions. QED. Thank you. Good night. Tip your waitress.
It's really wonderful in terms of world building, and just like, I feel like there is this lingering idea out there of magic being a corrupting force, right? And you see it appear, like, it's certainly present in Warhammer Fantasy RPG that magic directly corrupts you. DCC leans into this, right? Like of this idea that like, magic, that's a great, you know, you're meddling with stuff you shouldn't meddle with.
We agree. And so
I agree. I like how kind of how subtle D&D is about it. Of just like, we're not going to tell you that magic is evil, if you just read the spell descriptions and whatnot, I feel like this is similar to stuff like, there's always this, I feel like when I was young, it was consistently the sort of gamist versus, story.
Simulation? Oh, I see. Okay.
Not simulation, right? Like gamist versus sort of like a more like a story-driven, you know, narrativist kind of argument of players saying like, these things are available to me, so I should use them, right? These skills exist, these powers exist, I should use them because they're in the game. And why would they put them in the game if I can't use them to my advantage? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And then you have things that encourage the DM to subjectively punish the player for using those things. And I'm thinking of stuff like the Paladin, right? Or taking a cleric's spells away from them, right? This is like a thing that exists all the time. Oh, I'm changing your alignment. You've just modified your alignment, and now you've lost all your spells, lost all your powers, whatever, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like there were plenty of players who were like, well, no, I chose Paladin because cool powers. And then I use those powers because I can. And now you DM are judging me for my, you know, moral choices and not taking away my powers just because we disagree on the moral line of where my actions are.
Yeah. Good times.
I don't hate the idea of like of. And in fact, I think it would be enjoyable, frankly, to come at it of like, I'm going to start a new D&D campaign just with this basic concept of wizardry is evil. Yeah, magic is implicitly evil. And over time, you know, even the people who enter it with the best reasons, right? There's this power out there, and I'm going to use it to help humanity. Ultimately, if they stick with it for too long, it will corrupt them.
It's like D&D Breaking Bad.
It is. It's great. I love it.
Right? Exactly that.
I kind of don't hate that as a premise for a game.
Yeah.
But it's surprising to think that, like, you know, there are cases where I think I made the joke when you were first pitching this concept to me where I was like, so like Harry Potter is like, oh boy, I'm gonna go be a wizard, and I, you know, everything's great. And then just over time, he's gonna realize, like, oh, I made a bad choice. I'm going
over
down this horrible dark road.
You realize that the person who's controlling the world of Harry Potter is not a good person at all.
Oh dear.
Yeah, what a story that would be.
All right, Dan. All right, let's. I think we've tinkered long enough with the relativist morals of of D&D magic systems. Let's dig a little bit into some mechanical questions. There was a great question here from Vino Azul that I want to put up on screen. Which I'll read out here because it gets a little cropped here, which is, I have a question. If you use an invisible stalker to hunt down a wizard that is using a magic jar, does the invisible stalker chase the jar, the original body, or the possessed body? How would you rule this, Dan, if it happened in Wizard War? If after Steven cast his magic jar, I go, ha ha, invisible stalker. Now what?
Great. And this is such a Wizards Warzone thing to come at me. And my ruling will be wherever the soul currently is, I'm going to go with. So if the soul is in another body, go after that body. And after that, if it's in the jar, go after the jar.
I'm looking at this text here of Invisible Stalker because I was kind of curious about it. Does it say?
Oh, that's a whole other, that's a whole other pipeline. That's a whole other sinkhole.
And
don't forget that the spell Invisible Stalker may possibly contradict what the monster entry Invisible Stalker says in some critical ways.
Okay,
so just
sorry,
be aware
sorry,
of that.
Back away.
yeah.
So you think the rule you're ruling is the Invisible Stalker goes after the Wizard Soul wherever it happens to be right now.
Yes. That's what I'm going with. That's what I'm going with the Wizard Soul on right now. Yep.
Follow-up.
Yeah, what can the wizard, if the wizard's in the soul, the magic jar, and the Invisible Stalker goes after that later, can the wizard possess the Invisible Stalker?
What is an Invisible Stalker exactly, Dan? Because there was some, I saw some things about...
I don't know, I've never seen one.
Of course you haven't. There was some text in one of the magic jar. Jeez, I can't even remember which ones. First edition, third edition? I don't remember. There was some text about you can detect when you're targeting who you're going to possess, that you can detect both their relative power, right? Like, you can kind of tell the difference between a 12th level and a 4th level creature. But it also mentioned that you could detect positive energy versus negative energy. So presumably, like, if there's a... Oh, you're not aware of this one, other than from that look.
No, it's coming back. So I think it's basically like, is it undead, right? Negative energy would be something undead.
Is it undead? Right. So it tells me that, right, yeah, exactly. Exactly, right. So it specifies that, that undead will come across as negative energy. But what it doesn't tell me is, does that mean they're not a valid target?
No,
exactly. A zombie or not?
I kind of want to, it seems like the rules seem to say yes. And, you know, like in first edition, because some of this also kind of winds up, like in third edition, they're referencing polymorph once in a while. Like in first edition, and I find this very troubling, but it's black letter law in first edition. You can polymorph living stuff into undead and vice versa. Which I feel is highly troubling, because you can take something that's dead and just like hit it with polymorph, and now it's like a normal living creature. So probably in those early editions, they probably did intend that you could probably magic jar into undead, but I find that highly troubling, and I don't permit it in my house rules.
And it's funny too to me, because like I feel like there's a big difference of like, okay, let's say I magic jar my way into a zombie or a skeleton, like is there a soul coming back that I'm fighting with? Is there a soul there? Like I think maybe not. But what if it's a vampire? Or what if it's a lich? Can I?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then of course we get into the
right. Oh, no.
What if I target a lich, right? And this gets into like the sort of like nested magic jar problem. Right?
Yes.
I magic jar you. Well, I magic jar your magic jar, right? Like, oh god.
Yes. Yes. I magic jarred and you magic jar me. Does my soul go back to my jar or your jar? Or his jar? Does a daisy chain? Is there a daisy chain of wizards and jars? Is it just magic jars all the way down?
And I feel like then you end up in, you know, you advance that, you know, thousands of years and you end up in a Futurama-like world where there's a vault somewhere full of jars.
Yes.
Instead of holding heads, they hold souls.
Exactly.
A recursive.
Yep. So this is more or less why I went in Wizards Warzone, why I said you've all got magic jar. It's already been cast. The magic jar is outside the battlefield.
Yep.
You can't cast it in here specifically because this recursive problem started to rear its ugly head in my games. And I'm like, this is a very unusual spell. Like it says in first edition.
Yep, it is.
And
it
all
is. What
stuff.
A weird, weird spell.
Right? Totally.
All right, Dan,
I could imagine.
Go
ahead.
What? I was about to tell you where I'm at, so go ahead.
I like having this, as crazy as it is, this has inspired me for a lot of like backstory in my campaign. And you know, you can, if you're a DM, you have a rather vast buffet of options for Magic Jar, depending on what edition you want to tap for your understanding. And up through, you know, original first edition BX, this old stuff that we love, the spell is super powerful. It's basically creating a lich at the cost of one fifth level spell, more or less. It's infinite in duration. It is infinite in range. It's basically going to make your wizard immortal. Once you get to second edition and beyond, there's all of a sudden a whole bunch of restrictions on it. That's probably not the way it's going to work. Very limited range of return. In third edition, extremely limited duration of just like within a day. Interesting, fifth edition is back to until dispelled, which is an interesting take on it. Yeah. So you might want to think about like that particular spell, whether you want to dig into the implications in your campaign. And for some of us, that really fits nicely with the Vancian, sinister, disreputable wizards and the kind of the dark, ancient campaign world that we kind of like to play with, actually. But if that's not how you want to play your game, you might want to think about nerfing, excerpting, making the spell hard to find for wizards or something like that, because the implications are kind of horror movie jarring, frankly, and you may or may not want that in your game. No pun intended.
I like it for that reason, too. I mean, it makes me start to ask questions like, did all this come up because, right? Did the nerfing happen because somebody originally put it in the rule book just to explain the villain in the adventure they had written? And then now it's in front of the players. Now the players are using it and you go, whoa, wait a minute. I accidentally accidentally opened Pandora's box here. Let's rein it in. But I do like the influence it has on the world, the implications it has on the history. And I think it's fascinating to take that into consideration and then try to build your fantasy milieu on top of that idea of ultimately magic is corrupting and here is the prime example of it. I think that's super fun.
I do too. I agree. I'm glad it's there.
Dan, any final thoughts on Magic Jar?
Well, just that. I'm glad it's there. It is weird. I could imagine an alternate history of D&D where that wasn't on the standard spell list and they'd made liches first instead, and it was a lot harder to acquire that kind of immortality. But I do. I think it's one that you don't want to. It's one of the main lessons from my Wizards Warzone games that I'm so glad I have been playtesting to highlight and know a little bit more about before you just stumble into it. You're running a D&D game as a DM, and all of a sudden your players are ninth level, and all of a sudden Magic Jar shows up, and you haven't thought about how horrible it is. That's one where you do want to spend a little bit of time before it becomes acquired by your players about how you want to play it and what the implication is for your campaign world. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity for the DM to be creative in any different direction they want.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, I like that it exists as well. Even though I've never seen it used in any campaign I've ever run, I like that it's there, and I like it as a little touch of chaos that maybe one of these days I'm gonna have a player who is going to solve a problem with Magic Jar, and I look forward to that. I think that's gonna be fun and ridiculous and terrible and have long running implications on our game. And so I want it there just for that. Just for that, I want it.
I love it. It's like a trap on the spell list. I love it.
Yeah. Viewers, if you have any perspectives on Magic Jar, and especially any stories of how it may or may not have been used in your campaigns, we'd love to hear it. Please leave us a message here in the chat. Drop us a comment on YouTube videos here, and let us know how Magic Jar influenced your campaign. Maybe that will stir up some more thoughts for us for episode Part 2 of Magic Jar.
Definitely. Or maybe just liches or something like that. And, of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites, so please look for us there and chug down that like button!
Viewers, if you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com and through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And over on Patreon, you'll see that every tier gets you access to our private Discord server, among other benefits. And the conversation continues there 24/7 about all the stuff we love. Old school D&D, new school, science fiction, horror, miniatures, everything that we love. And our patrons are just the smartest, best people. So we'll be there for our live video after chat in about 10 minutes and get more of your thoughts. And the chat has been super, super busy here. We'll have to scan that for other ideas that we couldn't fit in the show here. And if, like Paul said at the top of the hour, $1, if you just tip it in there, we would love to have you join for the first time in our live after chat that's going to be happening in a couple minutes. We'll both be there. Anything happening? I guess that's basically it, right? We're making some scheduling plans for the summer and fall, but we certainly can't talk about that yet. Yep. That's what's happening at the moment, right?
You've got it.
So don't forget, viewers, thanks so much for tuning in. And we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.